Well, dear students, here we are at our final chapter covering stocks. We've come a long way, and we are going to end with the most supreme silliness that is associated with stocks, in my humble opinion. But first, we'll take a look at some important topics to understand, not that we have that much control over them, and that is what we call behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. This is nothing new, folks. Benjamin Graham said it a long time ago very, very well. The investor's chief problem, and even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself or herself. And this is the truth. This is the truth. As we saw in Chapter 4, when we saw that mutual funds do better than the mutual fund investors, the people who invest in them. Why? Because they get in at the absolute worst possible time. Ooh, 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 is it too late to get in? Everybody else has made a fortune. I want to make some too. And then they drop out, they pull out at the very worst possible time after the market tanks. Ooh, 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 is it too late to get out? So let's take a look at behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. Slide number 2. Investor what? Psychology, the study of psychos? I prefer to call it slycology. You like that? That's an old joke. I use slycology on them. In 1962, there was a brief recession and a sharp market downturn. The president's chief economic advisor was giving a presentation to many of the political and economic leaders of the time, describing what they were doing to right the economy. One of the attendees asked, "So when is the stock market going to recover?" The advisor curtly responded, "I am an economist, sir, not a psychiatrist." Yeah. Slide number 3. Because of the tremendous amount of money involved in the markets, much research has gone into trying to understand investor psychology. Some of the research is very revealing about who and what we are, not only as investors, but also as a species in general. In other words, it tells us about humans. It tells us about our traits and quirks and idiosyncrasies. There's an old Wall Street saying, there are three factors that influence the market. Fear, greed, and greed. Yeah, exactly. You know, you hear people say fear and greed, but it's usually fear and greed and greed. Greed usually wins out over the long term. Not always. There are times when fear is running rampant. But greed, boy, people are just, yeah. Slide number 4. Here are some common investor weaknesses. Reading too much into the recent past. Beware the permanent trend. This looks familiar, right? Yeah, we saw this in Chapter 7. The permanent trend is a cute saying quoted by Andrew Tobias. Things have been going really, really well. They must continue to go really, really well forever. Wrong. Things are going really, really badly. They're going to continue to go really... No. Even though there are countless examples of investors getting on the bandwagon, just as the wagon was about to veer into a ravine, we trick ourselves into believing that it's different this time. It's a new era. So you have to go back and look at yourself and see if you are one of those people who loves to jump on the bandwagon at the worst possible time. Did you pile into Apple or gold in 2011 and 12? Did you buy oil in mid-2008 when it was $147 a barrel? And 8 months later, it had gone down to $39 a barrel. How did that condo conversion flipper in early 2006 work out for you? Oh, not so good, huh? Oh, yeah. And then eToys, The Globe, CMGI, DrCoop.com. You don't remember any of these, do you? Webgrocer, Home, what was it, Webgrocer? Webvan and Home Grocer. Those were two companies that were going to deliver groceries to you. You put your order in over the internet, and you are going to have your groceries delivered to your doors. And they spent a ton of money. They bought all these $100,000 trucks that were with refrigeration and all the things in them. Spectacular bankruptcies, and those trucks were sold for 20-30% brand new, barely used. So don't read too much into the recent past. The only thing constant is change. Slide number 5, misperceiving randomness. Even though stock price movements in the short term are random, that's what our research shows us, our brains will trick us into seeing a pattern. We humans are heuristic. What does that mean? It means we look for patterns. Even if we know, or someone has told us, there is no pattern to be found, there aren't any to be found, our brains will say, yeah, there's a pattern there, there's another pattern there. And it's just something that we do. It's built into our genes to find those patterns. Even if we're told, no, there's no pattern, this is completely random. And this is an example here. If you study randomness and statistics, you will find that in a series of 1 million random digits, zeros through nines for a million, million of them in a row, the probability that one of those digits, anyone, you don't know which one, but 0 through 9, will be repeated 13 times in a row is essentially 100%. So if you have a computer or some other device that is creating random digits, and you create a million random digits, and you don't see one of those numbers repeated 13 times in a row, then you know that somebody's fudged the random number generator. Somebody's fudged the randomness. Because if you're a human and you're looking at those 1 million digits and you see 13 sixes in a row, you would say, this isn't random. Are you with me? Understand? Yeah, exactly. So we see a pattern where there's none to be found. And in my humble opinion, technical analysts are guilty of this failing. And we're going to discuss that at the end of this presentation. We'll discuss technical on that. Well, not the end. It takes up over half of the presentation. We've been mentioning technical analysis. Now we're going to actually spend some time doing it. But slide number 6, continuing with the common investor weaknesses, is being overconfident. Believing you know more than you think you know. Or believing you're better than most other investors, the truth is, folks, we are very, very small individual investors. We only see the tip of the iceberg with regard to what is happening within a company or an industry or the economy as a whole. And we are usually only average or mediocre investors at best, especially if we decide to try trading or speculating. Then, as we've seen, we're up against the best in the business. Yeah. And there's a name for this. It's called the Lake Wobegon effect. Huh? Later. Hang on a minute. First, I want you to answer this question. Are you an excellent, good, average, fair, or poor driver? And if you get 100 people in a room and ask them, over 80%, sometimes up to 90%, will say they are either excellent or good. A few will say they're average, and virtually none will say that they're fair or poor. Exactly. How can everybody be above average? Well, that's the Lake Wobegon effect. And you probably have never heard Garrison Keillor's news from Lake Wobegon, but dear students, it's a joy. And my humble opinion, other people will say it's too slow, but it's been on public radio for almost 40 years. And this gentleman by the name, he's a very excellent writer, Garrison Keillor, has a tagline for his news from Lake Wobegon. He talks about this mythical place where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. Right, how can everybody be above average? Well, that's the truth, you know. We all think we're really good and excellent drivers, and the truth is, no, we're mostly all average, and some of us are not so good at all. And the same thing is true for investors. If they think they're really, really good, and they're going to go up against the best in the business by being speculators and traders, all I can wish them is good luck. Slide number 7. Selling your winners too soon, hanging on to your losers. Now, we've discussed this a little bit in Chapter 7. It's called loss aversion. As humans, we hate to admit that we made a mistake. So we stubbornly hold on to our losers, hoping that they will at least get back to where we bought in so that we can say that we didn't make a mistake. It was just neutral. Think of the opportunity cost of hanging on to that. The reality, folks, is we are hardwired, so to speak. Our memories are wired, are set up, are configured to forget about unpleasant experiences. That's what we are. That helps us cope. So if you sell your losers, you'll quickly forget about them. They'll disappear from your conscience. However, if you hang on to them, every time you look at that screen or look at your statement, you're going to be reminded how stupid you were. Right? So it's as if we're masochistic so we don't admit that we make a mistake. We want to watch ourselves and beat ourselves up every time we look at the screen. In contrast, if you hang on to your winners, that's what makes an investor rich. You have a good company, has good long-term prospects. Hang on to it. Hold it forever, as Mr. Buffett says. I think I told you this about about Peter Lynch. When he was asked what his worst mistake was, his worst investing mistake, and he said, you know, when Home Depot came out, I bought it, and it went up 100%, I doubled my money, and I sold. And people, what? That's the worst mistake you made? It's not too bad. He goes, yeah, yes it is. It then went up 20 more times. Yeah, right. Hang on to your winners. Slide number 8. Okay, those were common investor weaknesses, and I want you to make sure you know those and be aware of them, because they're going to affect you too. You're an investor. Let's now review and take a look back at chapters 6 and 17 with regard to fundamental analysis. The fundamental analysis is the in-depth study of the financial condition and operating results of a firm. The method of evaluating securities by attempting to measure the intrinsic value of a particular stock. In other words, what kind of price can we assign to this stock? And we learn some valuation models. Fundamental analysts study everything from the overall economy and industry conditions to the financial condition and the management of the companies. Simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. And the valuation models from Chapter 6 and the work we did in Chapter 7, that is fundamental analysis. Right? Okay, so that should be review. Some of the fundamentals, the competitive position of the company, don't forget to research their competitors, its composition and growth in sales and earnings, dividends, if they're paying dividends, the profit margins, the dynamics of the company's earnings, are they growing, or are they stagnant, what's going on with their competitors, what's the composition and liquidity of corporate resources, what assets are available, the company's capital structure, how much debt, how much equity, that's called the capitalization of a company. And so these are things that we've already gone through. And as we gain experience and wisdom and knowledge investing, we find the ones that are most important to us. Yeah. But there are many investors who don't follow the fundamentals. They don't bother with taking a look at the company itself. They are called technical analysts. And so this is the other side of the spectrum. You look at squiggles on a screen. Exactly. The study of various forces at work in the marketplace and their effect on stock prices. Now, those who adhere to technical analysis believe that they can predict the future value of a stock by analyzing the behavior of the stock price's history and/or the overall stock market. They use any one or many of dozens of what are called technical indicators. Simply put, the future price of a stock is influenced by factors other than the company's fundamental future outlook. So a pure technical analyst wouldn't even bother with any of the fundamentals, whereas a pure fundamental analyst would not even care about all these technical indicators. Now, obviously, it's a spectrum. Some people are all to one side or another, and some people are in the middle somewhere, use some of this, use a little bit of that. I will tell you my personal bias. I think these people are all wet. I think these people are just fooling themselves, literally fooling themselves, as we saw one of the common investor weaknesses and problems is that they see patterns, even though the research shows us that the patterns are completely random. It doesn't matter. But we'll see that. We'll see that as we go along. You have to decide for yourself. Slide number 11. Argument in favor of technical analysis. Well, stock prices do tend to move in tandem to the stock market as a whole. When the market is rising, most, but not all, stocks rise with it. A rising tide lifts all boats is what you will hear people say. When the market is falling, most stocks are brought down with it. Or as Warren Buffett likes to say, when the tide goes out, you can see who was swimming naked. I like that. But the rebuttal is, hey, that's just supply and demand at work. When stocks are in favor, prices rise. When the economy is doing well, yeah. When stocks come out of favor, well, prices fall. Repeat after me. There has never been a reliable methodology for predicting the short-term behavior of the stock market. You see, folks, there are plenty of unreliable methodologies out there, and there are plenty of people who want to sell you those unreliable methodologies or sell you their advice that they use to predict unreliably the future short-term behavior of the stock market. When there is a reliable one, well, we'll do our best to find out how it works. The only one that was considered, they had done it, the short-term behavior, was in the 1990s, when two Nobel laureates and the best bond trader in the world got together and created a company called Long-Term Capital Management. And they were considered to have broken the code, to have figured out how to predict the market in the short term. And they failed miserably. it was just a horrible. First it looked really, really good, and then it reminds me of a child getting up and tottering across the room, and then, he's doing okay. Uh-oh, yeah, uh-oh. But this was a bigger uh-oh than somebody falling on their bum. The Federal Reserve Bank had to run in 1998 and bail them out, essentially. And, folks, it's like a prequel. It reads, if you read it, there's a book called When Genius Fails, and there's a wonderful Nova special called, Nova, called the Trillion Dollar Bet. And it's like a prequel to the 2008 disaster of the housing bubble, where many banks and insurance companies had to be bailed out. Yeah, we don't learn, do we? We don't learn. Okay, slide number 12. Let's take a look at some of the tools of technical analysis. Now, I don't want to pick on this stock market mentor guy, but I like him because he's so sure of himself. If you go to a few of his publicly available charts, he has a free one every day or every so often, and you can go to his website. And then he wants you to sign up and listen to his advice and learn how to trade. Again, I don't want you to do that, but that's your decision. It's your money. So you'll see he will use these tools, and he'll be serious about it, where I'll use the tools and I'll make light of it. I'll make fun of them. So you have to decide, who's right, and maybe you want to do a little bit of that and maybe you don't. It's up to you. So momentum buying, the trend is your friend, you'll hear people say. But we already showed that that was a very difficult strategy at best. Because it reminds me of musical chairs, right? As long as everybody's having fun, partying, the music's playing, you can keep swapping chairs all you want. But when that music stops playing, yeah, right. The housing bubble, right? The internet bubble. And they discuss these support levels and these resistance levels. Well, you look at the chart. We're going to see some charts in a bit. You'll see that there's a support level. This is a price or level below which a stock or the market as a whole is unlikely to fall. Now, where did they come up with this support level? They just empirically say, look, it went down to $10 a share three times, so that's the support level. It won't go below that until it does, then it breaks out on the downside. And then there's a resistance level. That's a price, say, $15, that it won't go above because, look, it hit 15 and then fell back and hit 15 and fell back and hit 15 and fell back and then it broke out on the upside. We'll see. You decide whether or not you trust these things. The psychological barriers. People, for some reason, like zeros. They like round numbers. And I'll tell you, I get excited when my car goes over 99,999 to 100,000 or whatever. Actually, it's getting closer to 200,000. But the Dow hitting 16,000 or 20,000. Now the next big barrier is 20,000. But it's got to get through 17, 18, 19 first, and maybe it goes down to 15, 14, 30. Who cares? Talk to me in 10 years. That's what I'm interested in. The S&P at 1,800. $100 for a stock. That's a psychological barrier. And then this other last technical analysis indicator on this slide is the moving average. Now, this one's kind of interesting. This one's kind of interesting because it's a calculation that, without the use of computers, would take you forever, but with a computer, it's a snap, and you go back 50 days, or 15 days, or 200 days, and you calculate the average for the last 50 days. And then the next day, you do it again. You go back 50 days, and you chart these moving averages and compare them to one another. And people believe, rightly or wrongly, that that is going to help you predict the future price movement. So let's take a look at an example on slide 13. What they have here is the 50-day and the 200-day moving average. And the 50-day is red and the 200-day is green. So when the 50-day, the red one, goes above the 200-day moving average, that's supposedly a good sign, right? That's supposedly a bullish signal. But if it goes down, I think I got it backwards here, right? I got it right. If the 50-day goes above the 200-day moving average, that's supposedly a very good signal. If it goes below the 50-day moving average, that's supposed to be a bad signal. And so this is just showing as only a few months here. I, on the website, have a presentation using Yahoo's 50-day and 200-day moving average. And it shows 5 years, so you get to see more. You know, you get to see more time. This is probably not. This is from your book, by the way. This is probably not the best example, because if you're going to do a 50-day and a 200-day moving average, you probably need to see at least 2 or 3 or 5 years. So probably what they should have done here is they should have used the 15-day and the 50-day, or that's a smaller time frame. But still, you get the idea. If this goes above, the red one, which is 50-day, goes above the 200-day, that's a good sign, right? And if it goes below, that's a bad sign. Well, it gets to the situation, maybe it does, it depends how many people follow it. It becomes what's called a self-fulfilling prophecy. If enough people believe that that's the truth, that that's what's going to happen, then they'll react accordingly and the price will go up or down depending on which way it goes. But when you actually take a look at some of these, and you'll look at the one on the website that I've done for you, you'll see that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. And sometimes it works really, really badly because you wait too long before the average is across. It's already too late. It's already jumped really high or already fallen really low. So take it for what it's worth, dear students. See the presentation, and then your optional bonus assignment is to do thou likewise, is to use these moving averages and whatever other technical indicators that you want to look up and use and figure out how to use, and convince me that you know what you're talking about. You don't have to know what you're talking about. You can play the technical analyst and make $500,000 and not know what the hell you're talking about and get big bonuses at the end of the year, and you probably do as good a job as anybody else on Wall Street doing technical analysis. Slide number 14, the Dow theory. Now, I've had this explained to me by two different people, and I still don't understand it. If you can figure it out, please explain it to me. It's one of the more historically popular price movement technical theories. It uses both the industrial average, which we already know to be a really bad index, a really bad benchmark, and the Dow Jones Transports average, which is not a bad one because it takes a look at what's going on with transportation. The Dow theory tries to identify three forces: a primary direction or trend, a secondary reaction or trend, and daily fluctuations. By watching the changes in the primary and secondary directions of the index, you are supposed to be able to determine the overall direction of the market. And supposedly, here's an excellent example. The primary direction is bearish, but there are secondary trends and corrections and reversions back to the primary direction. Which I think means that the market's going to go up and down. I think that's what that means. I'm not quite sure. If you can figure it out, please let me in on the secret, because I can't figure it out. As far as I can tell, the market goes up and down. That's what it means. Slide number 16. Yes, you see, I try to keep a straight face, but it's hard to try to. Relative strength. This is the measure of the performance of one investment relative to another or to the market as a whole. And there's a company called Valueline that we discussed that uses what's called the relative strength indicator. They're not the only ones. Another company that's very reliant, that concentrates on this relative strength indicator, is Investor's Business Daily, which is a competitor to the Wall Street Journal based in L.A., Los Angeles. And they rely on the relative strength indicator. That's, again, another technical indicator that shows, hey, this company is going to do well, or no, this company is not going to do well. The market volume, whether or not there's heavy volume or low volume. And in the presentation on technical analysis, you'll see the volume indicators telling whether there's a lot of stocks being sold or not too many. And this is the conventional wisdom, or the mythology, if you will. If there's heavy volume with prices rising, that's a good sign, right? Or if there's low volume with prices falling, that's okay. You know, it's all right. Prices are falling, but it's low volume. Don't worry. But if there's heavy volume with prices falling, uh-oh, that's bad. better run for the hills, sell all your stocks, learn to raise goats. And then if there's low volume with prices rising, well, you know, prices are rising, but it's not much volume, so that's not a good sign. Whereas the research to produce this so-called technical indicator, it ain't there. If you can find it, please show it to me. I'd be happy to change my mind. Slide number 17, the breath of the market. Not breath, not respiration, but what's going on in terms of how many stocks went up, how many stocks went down. That's called the breath. It's called the advance decline ratio. When the mood of investors is bullish, the number of advancing issues should outnumber the number of declining issues. That's called the advance decline ratio. So if there are more stocks going up than going down, that's supposedly a good sign. When the mood of investors is bearish, the advance decline ratio should fall. That's a bad sign. Well, again, I think it's just telling us that the market goes up and down. And so sometimes there's going to be more, when the market's going up, there's going to be more companies going up than down, and there's going to be other times when the market prices are falling, and that means more companies will be falling than are going up. So you decide whether or not that's useful to you. And then the tick, right? Remember the poly ticks and the tick? No, it's a different tick. And the name comes from the fact that there used to be these ticker machines that before the internet, before telecommunications, that, well, they were their own method of telecommunications, that would tell you what was going on with the market, to give you quotes on stocks and the market as a whole. And so if the market goes up or if a stock goes up, that's an uptick. And if the market goes down or if a stock, individual stock goes down, that's a downtick. And the opening tick is it going up at the beginning or is it going down at the beginning? The closing tick, is it a bullish tick? Is it a bearish tick? Or is it a poly tick? Yeah, okay. I try. I don't do a very good job, but I try to keep a straight face when I talk about these things. Slide number 18, short interest. Now, this one is actually pretty cool, in my humble opinion. This is the number of stocks sold short in the market at any given time, right? Now, you are going to see selling short in detail at the end of the semester, but right now all you have to know is that when people sell short, they are hoping for prices to go down or the market as a whole to go down. So the more stocks are sold short, the more investors, I think, the more traders, speculators, believe the market will fall. And for some reason, I don't know, again, where's the research, short investors are somehow considered more sophisticated and are therefore supposed to know when the market will fall. Do you remember the discussion about Sir John Maynard Keynes, and the sophisticated speculators who expected the market to fall and they were shorting and losing their shirts? The cool thing about this is it becomes a counter indicator. When large numbers of investors sell short, eventually they must buy back the shares. And we'll discuss how this works in detail when we get to selling short. But what happens, it's like pushing down on a spring. You're pushing down and down and down. Eventually the spring is going to go wee, jump up into the air. It creates a pent-up demand for stocks. So when there's a large amount of short interest, and you can look this up under key statistics for the individual stocks in Yahoo or are there any other website that you're interested in, and see how much short interest there is in a stock. And if there's a lot of short interest, it means one of two things. Eventually there'll be a short squeeze, that's what it's called, when the price starts going up again, all these people have to buy back in, and bingo, it flies back up again, prices will rise, or the company's going to go out of business, in which case the short sellers won. They will have won everything that they can win, because if the stock price goes to zero, they make out like bandits. So when in 2002, in August of 2002, it was reported that the number of shares that had been sold short, number of short sellers, was at the greatest level it had ever been in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. I took very good comfort in this. Why? Because eventually those people have to buy back those shares, which creates a rising environment. So I felt, okay, we're close to the bottom. And it turns out we were close to the bottom. The bottom was in October of 2009. Wasn't fun. 2002, I'm sorry. October of 2002. Wasn't fun. It's never fun when the market falls, folks. Believe me, I will tell you this before you see it happen or feel it happen. But it's going to happen. You just know it's going to happen. You don't know when. So short interest is actually, I believe, a good indicator, but for all the wrong reasons. They're looking at it, the technical analysts say, oh, there's a lot of short interest, that must mean the market's going to fall. And I look at it and I say, oh, there's a lot of short interest, that means the market's eventually going to rise. But we know that, don't we? Someday, eventually, the market's going to fall, and someday, eventually, the market's going to rise. Slide number 19, odd lot trading. Again, another dubious indicator. This is the theory based on the idea that small investors tend to buy and sell in odd lots. Remember what an odd lot is, right? Less than 100 shares. And the wisdom, for what it's worth, is the best thing to do is the opposite of what small investors are doing. Because small investors are supposedly stupider than large investors, which is, I don't know, I don't think the research bears that out. A lot of small investors are dumb, and a lot of small investors are smart. And a lot of large investors are dumb, and a lot of large investors are smart. If odd lot trading rises, it supposedly means that more and more small investors are rushing into the market. And they are supposedly notorious for getting into the market at the top of a bull market and pulling out at the bottom. Well, we know people do this. We know it happens. But the research and data behind this theory are very suspect. Plus, technology has made odd lot trading commonplace. It's not a big deal anymore. You don't have to. Nobody cares if you buy 17 shares versus 100 shares. It just doesn't matter because of technology. It used to be very important for the traders on the floor because it facilitated trading. But now with technology, don't worry about it. Slide number 20, contrarian opinion. Well, actually, there's something to be said for this, and we've covered contrarian strategy already. You buy when others are selling, and you sell when others are buying, but there's a problem with that. The market historically has gone up three times more often than it goes down, so if you're always selling while people are buying, pretty soon you won't have anything to sell. But the contrarian opinion technical indicator is the theory that if people are optimistic, that is a predictor of falling prices for the market. And if people are very pessimistic, that's a predictor of rising prices. So here's part of the psychology. We should all walk around going, oh man, everything's horrible, market's going to fall, we'll all be bearish, and that will make the market rise, right? You know, you could drive yourself insane thinking about these things. But there is a gentleman by the name of Mark Hulbert who writes for the Wall Street Journal, MarketWatch.com, and for, what, 30 years now? Over 30 years, he has been tracking all these investment newsletters, advice newsletters that sell a service. Sometimes you buy it, you know, monthly. Sometimes you buy it yearly or put a big lump sum in or whatever. And these people give out recommendations. And what he has done is he has shown that when these people all become bullish, that's a time to sell. And he's shown when all these people become bearish, that's a time to rise. So you see, these are supposed to be very sophisticated, very intelligent advisors, and yet they're just as bad, supposedly. They do just as stupid things as the supposedly the small investor. So contrarian opinion is a technical indicator that, in my mind, is actually pretty good. But again, you can drive yourself insane. We should all walk around and talk about how horrible everything is to make the market rise. And we shouldn't get optimistic because that'll make the market fall. I like the term cautiously optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic. Because the alternative is that the world's going to fail, and I don't want to think about that. Slide number 21, charting. Okay, here we get to the meat of the technical analysis, the heart, looking at little squiggles on a screen. Charting is the activity of charting price behavior and other market information and then using the patterns these charts form to make investment decisions. There are high, low, close charts, candlestick charts, which are bar charts, right, that are adapted to stocks, and chart formations. There's resistance in the support levels until finally it breaks out. The dreaded head and shoulders. Triangles, flags and pennants, cups and saucers. Supposedly this cup and saucer is something that the Investor's Business Daily talks about all the time. So let's take a look at the open, high, low, close charts. And I'm not exactly sure what you're supposed to make of these things, but the idea is if it's red, it's gone down that day. If it's black, it's gone up. And then there's the opening, the little tick over here and the little tick on there, and that's where it closed. And if you see a whole lot of black, that's a good sign. You see a whole lot of red, that's a bad sign. But after you see a whole lot of red, that's actually a good sign, usually, but not always, depending if the company goes out of business or not. So, I don't know, you decide whether or not it's useful to you. And then the candlestick charts. Remember the black going down, and in this case it's not, and the other one was red and black. These are gray, that's going up, and then the black is going down. And the longer the body, the more bullish or bearish the implication may be. And so here we have some candlestick chart formations. And, you know, again, I got to keep a straight face while I do this, but I think it's ridiculous. You look at day one, the price went up. On day two, it went down. This is a dark cloud cover. Obviously not very good. But then this is a bearish engulfing pattern. This is really not good. But then this one is supposedly horrible, and I don't know why, but it's a Japanese word, so it must be horrible. It's harami, and I don't know what it means. And I've asked people who speak Japanese, and they don't know what it means either. So I don't know if it is Japanese. But whatever, these are bad. They don't show you the good ones. They show you the bad ones. But you should be very, very afraid, aren't you? That's kind of like television news. Slide number 25. Now, here's the really bad one, folks. This is the really bad one. This is called head and shoulders. Doesn't it look like head and shoulders? You see, there's the head, there's the left shoulder, the right shoulder, and there's the neckline. And that's bad. Don't ask me why, but it's bad. And on the Series 7, when I took it way back in 1998, this was the only question about technical analysis. All they asked you, at least me, when I took it, was one of the most popular charting examples, one of the most popular technical charts is called blank, and then the answer was head and shoulders chart. I don't know why it's bad, but it's bad. So if you see a head and shoulders, maybe it's because it's associated with dandruff, right? The shampoo by the same name. Anyway, slide number 26. And here are a few others that are good or bad. Here's the resistance level. You see this, the price keeps hitting whatever it is, 15, and then can't go above that, and it goes back down to 10. So that's the support level. So it goes back up to 15 and then goes down to the support level, then back up and then down to the support, and then breaks out on the upside. It has nothing to do with the fact that their drug was just approved, right? Or that the market's all of a sudden doing really well because there's new growth in the economy and people are happier and more optimistic. No, it's because there's it's resistance and a support level, and they tell you what those numbers are. And then here's another resistance and support level, but it breaking out on the downside. That's bad. Triangles, I'm not exactly sure what that means. And flags and pennants, I really don't know what it means. But whatever, all I can say is good luck. And on the website is a spreadsheet that I want you to take a look at, because what it does is it randomly selects a year's worth of stock returns. And I used my vast experience with statistics and modeling, which I did a million years ago, and came up with a very simple spreadsheet that simply mimics a stock's price for a year. It's totally random. And I want you to download that spreadsheet and open it up and then just press function key 9. And what you're going to see is sometimes these charts pop out at you. You understand? They look beautiful. And usually they don't. You can't come up with much of anything. And it goes back to what we said at the beginning of this presentation, in that many investors, because we're heuristic animals, because we see patterns, even though they might not be there, whether we know it or not, they will get all excited because they see this pattern. But the reality is it's random. You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? So check that spreadsheet out, and then hold down function key 9, and what you'll see is it just starts looking like white noise. And if you know anything about radio waves and the like, and you've worked with an oscilloscope, you know what white noise is. It's just noise. In the short term, that's what a lot of noise, and that's what you noticed if you turn on the radio or the television or go on the internet. Yes, a lot of noise from people who are trying to sell you toothbrushes and they're not selling you cigarettes anymore, at least, but beer and life insurance. Slide number 27. You too, dear students, can be a technical analysis. The market's rise after a period of reaccumulation is a bullish sign. Nevertheless, fulcrum characteristics are not yet clearly present, and a resistance area exists 40 points higher in the Dow. So it is clearly premature to say the next leg of the bull market is up. If in the coming weeks, a test of the lows holds and the market breaks out of its flag, a further rise would be indicated. Should the lows be violated, though, a continuation of the intermediate term downward trend is called for. In view of the current situation, it is a distinct possibility that traders will sit in the wings awaiting a clearer delineation of the trend, and the market will move in a narrow trading range. Now, this is real, folks. This is a quote from a random walk down Wall Street. This is a real quote from a technical analyst. But what did he or she say? What's a translation? I think what this person said is if the market does not go up or down, it will remain unchanged. Do you agree with me? I mean, if you can figure it out, yeah, I think they're saying the market could go up, the market could go down, and the market could stay the same. They're absolutely right. And they're making $400,000 a year, folks. But they live in New York, so it's very expensive to live there. But still. Yeah. Okay. Slide number 28. Our last slide with regard to stocks, dear students. And I often think I should put this at the beginning of the... maybe because by now you've given up on me. Oh, God. This stuff is so ridiculous. Dear Lord, a registered representative, there are many, many, many opportunities in the financial industry, but many people will start as a before they start as a registered representative, they'll be working as a broker's aide, a broker's assistant, but this is their way into the industry. And that's the real term. Registered representative is the legal term for a stockbroker. I like financial representative. That's the one I like the best. Account executive, some people call themselves financial planners. If you want to be a registered representative, they're going to do a background check. Yeah, the FBI is going to get involved. They're going to take your fingerprints. You got to make they'll make sure that there's no shenanigans with other people's money. Folks, you can't be a flake, okay? They love ex-military because these are people who have lived in a structured, regulated environment. They want more women, they want more bilingual, and they're actively hiring now because many of the stockbrokers who got in the business in the 70s are retiring. So it's a good time to get into the business. You're going to have to take the Series 7. It's a tough test, folks. I won't sugarcoat it, but it's not impossible. It's 6 hours, 3 hours in the morning, get an hour for lunch, and then 3 hours in the afternoon. It's tough. And they tell you, you know, we're going to ask you questions that you don't even know the answers to. But don't worry, they're not included on the test. But they just ask them anyway. Figure that one out. But it takes about 2 months of studying, 1 to 2 hours a day. But the good news is you're learning the fundamentals. Now you got to learn all the other stuff that you'll never even use. And the tricky parts are the options and futures, and margining and shorting. These are things we discuss at the end of the semester, and you will see some of the problems that really drive people nuts. And you really have to respect those problems, because what happens is the test is actually 7 or 8 tests. There's 7 or 8 sections. Now, you don't see this. You just see 120 questions and then an hour off for lunch and then another 120 questions. But you have to pass every part of the exam with 70% or above, not just the whole exam with 70%. And so what people do is they'll blow off the options, blow off the shorting, and that's where they'll get tripped up on. And usually they pass it the second time if they miss it the first time. The second exam is called the Series 66. Some states ask you to do 63, but that's really easy. It's an hour. It takes about 2-3 weeks of studying. You must be sponsored by a brokerage firm. Some brokerage firms exist simply to sponsor people, and this was certainly the case about 20 years ago when many of the brokerage firms were not sponsoring new employees because they didn't need them. So you had to basically pay a fee to them for the privilege of being sponsored. Well, the states did not like this. States don't like companies asking people to pay a fee to take a test just so they can be a stockbroker or any other type of employee. So they were getting angry, and they were, in fact, the state of California was threatening to sponsor their own brokers. And then the brokerage firms came along and said, oh, you know, we need people, we're gonna loosen up the standards. And now many brokerages are sponsoring new recruits. So how do you do this, folks? Well, first, you're learning the basics. And we've had students who, with their spiffy new suits and get all dolled up and get that resume perfect, not a single typographical error, and go out to internships through our internship program, or go out to job fairs and sell themselves as a intern or a broker's assistant or a broker's aide with the idea of eventually becoming a registered representative. And what they will do is they'll pay you a salary at first, but eventually you're going to move to commissions. And I got to tell you, folks, the first few months, for a couple of years, it can be rough, because you're calling, you're busting your little fanny to get new clients. But it's a lot of fun, I believe. It's a lot of fun because you're helping people achieve their financial goals. It's very rewarding, I believe. Other people say, this is ridiculous. I hate cold calling, and it might not be for you. But I enjoy it, so you decide. And that, dear students, is our discussion of behavioral finance and psychology of investing, and the very last chapter and slide for stock investing. Because now we're ready to start bonds. Yeah. All the exciting stuff is over, folks. Now we look at bonds. See you in Chapter 9 on bonds. But first, yeah, go back over this, make sure you understand everything we have to do about stocks.